The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of the New Yorker and WNYC Studios.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick.
Monet, your left foot.
When Janelle Monáe came on the scene in pop music about 10 years ago, you might not have picked her out right away as a future star. Her music was rooted in soul and R&B and also punk and new wave. And Monáe wrote these kind of sci-fi concept albums set in the future, starring herself as an android. It was just kind of out there, kind of weird sometimes, and it could have been ridiculous, except it wasn't. It was great. And Janelle Monáe actually got the acclaim and recognition that she deserved. More recently, she started acting seriously in film as one of the stars of Hidden Figures and in Moonlight. And this year, she released an album called Dirty Computer. Despite the title, it's not science fiction at all. She's dealing frankly with the issues that she's facing and that our country is facing right this very moment. She joined me in the studio, and I wanted to begin at the very beginning. So at The New Yorker, we have a whole fact-checking department.
Yeah.
So I want to start with a fact-checking thing.
Sure.
I read that as a kid, you wrote an entire musical inspired by the Stevie Wonder album, Journey Through the Secret Life of Plants, all about photosynthesis. What was it like? What was this musical like?
Well, my uncle was a huge Stevie Wonder fan, and he played the album. And then I was like, oh, we're learning about photosynthesis in our school. And I started to just write about me because I was living with my grandmother at the time. We were in between houses, and I started to write about me and just this attack on, attack on humans from plants.
How old were you?
Shoot, I had to be in like elementary school because we had science class in maybe like the fourth or fifth grade.
Who were the writers and even performers or songwriters that were just inflaming your imagination when you were that young?
When I was young, I was really influenced because I was with my family. If you grew up in a big family like me, I have over 50 first cousins.
Wow.
My grandmother had 12 children.
Wow.
And I have a huge family. And so I was just with them a lot. And I come from a musically inclined family. My great-grandmothers both play organ and piano at their churches. The church was a huge inspiration for me growing up.
Did you sing in church in the way that singers that from an earlier generation did, the way Aretha kind of grew up knowing the music of Sunday morning and Saturday night?
You know, I did sing in church, but it's not the type of song that you would think would be sung in church.
It's not traditional gospel.
I actually was that 5-6-year-old kid who would be sitting in the pew, and my pastor would be between yelling and sweating and about to get the Holy Ghost, and I would bust out and sing Michael Jackson's Beat It, and then I'd be escorted out to the children's church.
You kind of got kicked out.
Yeah, I was a rebellious Christian.
Now, you were also interested in musicals and musical theater, and did you have access to that, or was it all through records and radio?
I did have access to musical theater, and
what roles did you play as a kid?
I was Cinderella.
I can totally believe it.
Yeah, we did a production. I went to a predominantly all-black high school, Latino and black high school. And
You got all the leads, didn't you?
I didn't actually. It's funny.
When did you not get the lead?
The Wiz. I did not get The Wiz. I wanted to be Dorothy so badly.
You're still mad about it.
Kind of. I'm kind of still, but I understood it, but it crushed me growing up. It really crushed me.
Now, at what point did you think I can have a big life? Like something that's beyond being in the High School Musical, something beyond being maybe the best singer at your high school, something larger than that?
I don't think it registered until I went to New York post-high school. I went to the American Musical and Dramatics Academy, and I started to learn more, and I started to grow. And when I realized that there was just more potential that I hadn't tapped into, there was just unaccessed potential that was there, and that led me to leave. I left school because I realized that I wanted to tell fresher stories.
Who were your heroes at that time?
Lauryn Hill. Lauryn Hill was my biggest inspiration, and I loved Judy Garland.
Yeah?
Lauryn Hill and Judy Garland were my heroes.
Those are pretty different performers. Why those two?
They were just women that I felt really used their voices. They had, first of all, a unique tone, and they just came across as strong. I didn't know a whole lot about Judy Garland. Mm. Obviously, I'm from Kansas and The Wizard of Oz, you know, and her being in that. I felt like she was a dreamer and she was a strong woman. I know she had a complex life. But Lauryn Hill in particular resonated with me as a Black woman who did an album and made a career fully being herself. She did not shy away from her religious beliefs. She didn't shy away from, you know, being a mom during a time where people said that she could not have a child, it would ruin her career. She was an actress. She was an actor. She was a singer. She was a producer. She was a polymath, and that was how I wanted to model my career.
Now, let's hear a song from an early album that's called Violet Stars, Happy Hunting, and this is from an album called Metropolis, The Chase Suite.
I'm an alien from outer space. I'm a cyber girl without a face, a heart or a mind.
I'm a product of the middle. I'm a product of the man.
Oh my goodness, I haven't heard it in a long time.
Now that sounds like something out of a musical. Is that what you set out to write?
Yes. You know what? Well, I wouldn't say a musical. What I wanted to do was figure out how I could sing songs, have concepts for them if I wanted to talk about science fiction, which was a huge inspiration to me after I watched Fritz Lang's 1927 German Expressionist silent film. When I watched that...
Metropolis.
Oh, yes. It inspired all of my work, really. It was the birth of Metropolis, the EP that Violet Stars, Happy Hunting, that we just heard. But what I wanted to do was figure out how can I take all of me on stage? Like, I am theatrical. I love singing. I love R&B. I love rock and roll. I love, you know, dressing in this black and white tuxedo to pay homage to my family. I love David Bowie. I had just gotten into Bowie at that time. I love Pink Floyd's The Wall. I love Isaac Asimov. I love science fiction. How can I blend all these different elements and innovate in the space of music?
Now, you had, in those early days, an alter ego, Cindy Mayweather. Why? It's not that you were hiding behind her, but you were projecting this self, which was a complicated thing, which I'll let you explain. why use her, as it were, instead of being yourself and as you are now in the latest album, Dirty Computer?
Well, I think that Cindy Mayweather represented aspirations for me.
Mm-hmm.
That's who I strive to be more like.
How so?
She is in the future, and in the future, she's more evolved, and she doesn't have ego. All the things that make me imperfect, she's able to master those.
So this is a self-critical expression by having an alter ego?
Yes.
In some way?
Absolutely.
What were you being self-critical about in your younger self?
Well, my younger self, I just felt... misunderstood a lot. People would call me weird. They'd be like, right. Oh, that's not commercial enough. they just did not understand how they were going to market what it was that I was doing. And just
what did they want you to be?
I don't think it was about wanting me to be something. I think it was really about not wanting to do the work and the development that it would take to figure out how to bring something new to the industry. It was like the quick thing would be, well, you know, change your hair, one, change your outfits, you need to sexually be appealing. The songs also, they shouldn't be so dense. They should be more simple and accessible. But
the temptation to fold must have been something financially and in terms of fame and all the things, the rewards that the record industry can bring. The temptation to kind of compromise a lot must have been significant.
Oh, yes. Oh, my goodness. Are you kidding me? I'd just been fired from Office Depot because I was responding back to one of my three fans that I had at the time. I was singing on the library steps, living in the house with six other girls in a boarding house, driving my Mitsubishi Galant, selling my CDs out of my trunk. I needed money. I needed to be successful.
Broke.
Yes, I was broke.
What
I didn't want to go home.
What'd you do at Office Depot?
Selling ink.
And you were bad at it?
Slanging ink. Yep. You said, was I bad at it?
Yeah.
No.
I'm sure
I
you
was
were good
at it. Absolutely.
So what kind of scrape did you get into?
I was responding to one of my three fans on the company's computer. And I was just trying to tell them, hey, I'll be at the library steps and meet me at 7 o'clock. And they were like, Janelle, come to the back. And they just made it easier for me. I don't think I would be here right now had I been working there, because I would have kept making excuses.
Tell me about the decision to make Dirty Computer. First, what a dirty computer means is it has a really rich meaning in the lyrics of these songs, first of all. And second of all, the album is about you. It's no longer a throne character. It's no longer an alter ego. It's about Janelle Monáe. It's about identity. It's about oppression. It's about sexuality and marginalization and much else. And you're speaking in your own voice, not the voice of a character.
Well, I guess it depends on how you look at it. I think we all are characters and we have aspects of us that we allow to be seen. This is a concept and a part of me that I had before I released my first album, The Archandroid. So they're all connected. All the albums are connected. This is sort of a prelude. I wrote the Dirty Computer album in the Obama era, and then things shifted in November of 2016.
And you're right, but you're writing the album in the Obama era with what kind of head? Meaning, how was the Obama era influencing what you're doing?
Oh, I was inspired. I was inspired by seeing, not just our first African-American president, but someone who genuinely cared about the people that I cared about.
How deep into the creation of Dirty Computer were you when along came Donald Trump in the election of 2016?
I was deep. I was probably 70%.
Did it interrupt the process?
It did. Absolutely.
Did you almost abandon it?
I took a break because I would go into the studio upset and angry. And then it didn't turn into this just album that was Janelle Monáe centered. Community kept coming up, and it was like, we need to build a community, because right now, the people that I care about and the things that I care about are being erased through laws, through media. And I want to create this project and a tour experience that allows all the dirty computers in the world, those who are told because they're unique or they're
dirty
different.
Dirty computers mean nonconformist in some way or not. Well, you explain it.
Well, a dirty computer is someone who is told their bugs and their viruses are negatives, and a dirty computer sees themselves or sees those bugs and viruses as attributes, as features. And this project is about the erasure of identity and what it means to hold on to your identity despite what the world says about you, and how, we have a vice president that is talking about conversion therapy, mm-hmm. We have
so-called fixing the computer.
Yeah, we have outright just racist, sexist remarks around women and black folks. immigrants, to those in the LGBTQIA plus community, to lower class citizens, to just like my parents and my grandparents, would be considered a dirty computer.
Yeah. Let's listen to a song from the new album called Make Me Feel.
Baby, don't make me spell it out for you. All of the feelings that I got for you can't be explained, but I can try for you. Yeah, baby, don't make me spell it out for you. You keep on asking me the same questions. Why? And second guessing all my intentions. Should know by the way I use my compression that you got the answers to my confessions. It's like I'm powerful with a little bit of tender and emotional sexual bender. Mess me up, yeah, but no one does it better. There's nothing better. That's just the way you make me feel.
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 Now, this song is, if I'm reading it right, is all about sexuality. The first line is, baby, don't make me spell it out for you. Were you getting pretty sick and tired of having to spell it out for people, meaning your own sexuality?
Well, I felt like I did. I mean, if people listen to my projects, you know, I have songs that never shied away from talking about sexuality. I think that I am a private person, and I do not, and I still to this day don't like talking about my personal relationships. But I think this was after the election, and just as I was working on this project, I knew that once people saw Dirty Computer, the emotion picture, the short film that I did, and they listened to the album, I knew people would ask questions. And at that point, it was just like, you know, it felt right.
I saw you perform at Madison Square Garden at the Hulu Theater.
Yeah.
When you look out into that audience, what are you looking out into? Who are those people? Who are your people? Who's your audience?
So I would say that, you know, I had to remind myself that when I take off my makeup, when I take off my tour outfit, the truth is I am a young Black queer woman who grew up to working class parents. And a grandmother who served food in the county jail for 25 years. That is my life. And when I look out, I see people that every single day are told that they don't matter. And that feels like a direct attack on the people that I love and that I care about. There's a sense of responsibility that I feel and an obligation that I feel like I have.
Is there a sense of guilt too?
Yeah. You know, I feel like, man, why are they having to, you know, go through
hell?
Yeah. Well, I feel a sense of guilt because I'm like, man, I have a voice. Like, I'm voicing my frustrations. Some people can't. They'll be fired from their jobs. You know, they'll be ostracized from their communities. It makes me want to do more and give more.
We're going to hear the song Django Jane. And before we do, I'd love to know who this song was written for.
Django Jane was written for me, for women. It's a response to feeling like your rights as a woman are being trampled on.
They doing outstanding, running out of space in my damn bandwagon. Remember when they used to say I look too mannish? Black girl magic, y'all can't stand it, y'all can't ban it. Made out like a bandit. They've been trying hard just to make us all vanish. I suggest they put a flag on a whole nother planet. Jane Bond, never Jane Doe, and I Django, never Sambo. Black and white, yeah, that's always been my camo. It's looking like y'all gonna need some more ammo. I cut them off, I cut them off, I cut them off like Van Gogh. Now, pan right for the angle. I got away with murder, no scandal. Cue the violins and violas. We gave you life, we gave you birth, we gave you God, we gave you earth. We've him the future.
So, we've met once before, much more memorable for me than for you. But there was, not long before Trump took office, a huge gathering at the White House, mainly not for press. There were some reporters there, but there were a lot of performers, athletes, people in the business world gathered at the White House. The DJ for this, I should say, was Questlove.
Yes.
Solange performed. A lot of people performed. And at one point, you started dancing. I forget with who was it. You were dancing with somebody for about a half an hour. People gathered around
yeah.
you. And you came off. I would have been dead. You were seemed to be a little bit tired.
Yeah.
And I asked you, aren't you exhausted? And you said, I'm not exhausted because I know I ain't going to be invited back here for a very, very long time. Can yeah. you describe that night, what your memories of it were?
Oh, my goodness. I just remember a lot of celebration, but sadness under that celebration. And just to think like, man, all the hard work that he had done and was going to be unraveled and undone and control Z deleted. I do remember saying that to you. And but what I will say is I want to focus on now. And right now I'm working with an organization, When We All Vote, to help get awareness out. After studying the 2012 election and this past 2016 election, there was a 7% decrease in the black vote. Imagine if we would have showed up. What could have happened?
Janelle, thank you so much. Janelle Monáe.
Thank you for having me.
Dirty Computer is the title of Janelle Monáe's most recent album. You're listening to the New Yorker Radio Hour with more to come.
Pink like the inside of your baby. Pink behind all of the doors. Crazy pink like the tongue that goes down.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On the Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to the Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
I'm David Remnick, and thanks for joining us on the New Yorker Radio Hour. In the late 80s, I got a job in the Moscow bureau of the Washington Post, so I had to set out to learn Russian, and it was really difficult. And I was pretty damn proud of myself, even acquiring a rudimentary grasp of the language, because unless you grow up with a language, it's hard for at least most of us to learn a new one, unless you're somebody like Luis Miguel Rojas Bircha, who's what we call a hyper-polyglot.
Let me say something in Shawi to my Shawi friends.
Yes, please.
Shawi is a language that your high school probably didn't offer. It's spoken by about 20,000 people, mostly in the Amazonian rainforest.
I'm in love with Shawi. I have lived many experiences with the Shawi. I had problems there. They helped me when I almost died 3 years ago in an accident. But I'm a polyamorous in terms of languages. And Shawi is my wife or husband.
Shawi isn't Luis Miguel's first language either. It's not his second or his third. He doesn't even know how many he speaks. 20-something?
I speak some 13, 14 languages fluently. And the others, there are some that I know the grammar, that I can have some basic conversations. Judith says I have 28, right?
Well, if the fact checker ran this past you, don't look at me.
Mandarin, Farsi, Portuguese, Esperanto, Ancient Greek, Biblical Hebrew, the list goes on. Judith Thurman wrote about him in The New Yorker because she's fascinated by these hyper-polyglots, people who seem to have no limit to how many languages they can absorb. And when Luis Miguel made his first trip to New York recently, Judith took him out to Queens, where he could practice at least a few of his favorites.
This is my advice, but it's very personal, it's just an opinion. If you want to learn a language from a school, that doesn't happen. You have to learn a language on the street. Talk to people.
But not everybody has your guts. I think that it's true. You have to be very extroverted. You have to have a sense of shamelessness, you know, just to go and talk to people on the street. And yeah. I think there's an inhibition, shyness, inhibition, timidity, especially when you don't speak the language that which you don't have. You are sort of remarkably free.
But you have to get rid a bit of that inhibition if you want to speak a language, because languages emerge in interaction. Language is something very personal. And when you just approach someone and ask, hey, do you speak this language? Would you like to teach me some words? It's weird. That happened to us actually
in Malta. They couldn't figure out, A, what we were doing together and what we were there for. And we wanted them to talk to us. And
People thought that we were more than just two friends wandering around Malta. They're learning Maltese. One of them said, please stop flirting and go to the point. It's like, well, this is the point. I'm looking for a tea I love that comes from Taiwan, from the Ali Mountains. My Ali Shanti got lost because my bag is still missing. Maybe that's why my bag got lost. There was a crazy Taiwanese that stole my bag because it was full of Ali Cha. Nah.
And you learned Chinese in adolescence as a teenager, right?
Yeah, I was 13, 14 when I started learning Chinese out of a challenge, because my dad said that I was wasting too much time learning French, because he wanted me to be a businessman. So he said, China will be the economic power in the future, so you have to learn Chinese. He said, okay, let's go together, I said. After 2 months, he failed and surrendered, and I continued. And I fell in love with Chinese. I'm getting hungry, so.
Go upstairs here?
Can you read Tibetan? Payul. Yeah, Payul restaurant. Are they Tibetan?
Yeah.
Okay, then we will explore the Tibetan numerals, which are really interesting.
What's interesting about them?
Well, we'll see that.
Okay. So you want the beef tongue, plain lassi, vegetable lappi, and potato momo, chicken momo, right?
Yes.
Spicy is okay, right?
Spicy is okay. Are you Tibetan? Can we ask you for just a little favor? He's a linguist. Would you tell him the numbers in Tibetan?
The numbers.
Numbers?
Yeah. How do you say one in Tibetan?
Chik.
Chik. Two?
Ni.
Ni. Three?
Sum.
Sum. Four?
Shi.
Shi. Five?
Nga.
Nga. Six?
Two.
Two. Seven.
Du.
Du. Eight.
Ge.
Nine.
Ku.
Ku. Ten.
Chu.
Chu. It's the beautiful thing is that you see in Tibetan, if you compare the numbers with Chinese numbers, they're almost the same. It's like in Japanese, like ancient Chinese. Ichi ni san sa, ichi ni san shi, chi ni sum shi, you know? Almost the same.
in the Tibet, you know, there's a lot of Chinese, you know. Because of that, I can understand. Also, I've been in India, so I lived there for 3 years. So, so are you Chinese?
I am from the world. You never know a language. Languages are ideals, unattainable ideals. Every time, even if I'm in a Spanish-speaking barrio, there are people speaking ways I haven't heard before. Every time I go back to Peru, I know I'm Peruvian, I have friends there, but my Spanish has changed a bit. I don't have the brand new slang I speak like 10 years ago. I feel like a foreigner everywhere, and I think that's a bit of an advantage if you want to learn a language, to have a bit of distance. Peruanos, los paisanos, importadores de productos típicos ecuatorianos, mexicanos, peruanos, colombianos, centroamericanos. And the flag of my country is also there, twice even. Can we go and have a look? No, there is no air conditioning. I'm looking for something I used to drink when I was... Oh, yes!
What's that?
Inca Cola. Inca Cola is the Peruvian soft drink. Most foreigners dislike it. They say it tastes like chewing gum. And I would say it does. No tiene Inca Cola helada.
¿De cuál querías? ¿Pequeña?
Pequeña, sí. Sí, sí, sí tiene. Ah, quiero una entonces. Este es la bebida que del Perú. Oh, sorry, I'm speaking Spanish. You see, I forget. ¿Cuánto es?
Luis Miguel Rojas Bercha, a linguist who speaks a couple of dozen languages in Queens, with staff writer Judith Thurman. I'm David Remnick, and that's the New Yorker Radio Hour for today. Thanks for listening. Next week, please join us for Andy Borowitz and Harry Shearer in character as Derek Smalls of Spinal Tap. A match made in heaven. See you then.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Abe Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Jill Duboff, Karen Frillman, Cal Alia, David Krasnow, Louis Mitchell, Sarah Nix, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Emily Mann, Richard Yeh, and Jessica Henderson. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.